Your source for everything paranormal.
Para-X.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Everybody, and welcome once again to Stirring the Cauldron. My guest tonight is author Lilith Dorsey, and she's been active in the pagan community for almost three decades and has a background in many magical traditions, including Celtic, Afro-Caribbean, and Native American spirituality, some Haitian voodoo, some New Orleans voodoo, and some Santeria. She's the author of several books, including Voodoo and the American African-American Paganism, and Love Magic, which we talked about when she was here last, when it was first released. And tonight we're going to be talking about her new book, Orishas, Goddesses, and Voodoo Queens, which is about the divine feminine in the African religious traditions. So, Lilith, oh my God, I can't talk today. It's nice to be back for a visit.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back, Marla. I'm excited to talk about this book. I really, really am.
It is an exciting book. And with African traditional religions and women's issues getting stronger than ever before, it's very timely. I mean, I've had so many authors on the show lately who have written about the divine feminine, like Nicholas Pearson, Stones for the Goddess, and a book called When God Had a Wife by Lynn Picnic and Clive Prince. And that's all about the fall and the rise of the sacred feminine in the Judeo-Christian tradition. So why do you think this is like coming around again? I mean, you know, everything old is new again, but I think this is the time. Why do you think so?
No, it's true. I mean, and when you were saying that, all I could think of is it's like it's not your mom's feminism. You know what I mean? Because I think that there's a female empowerment now that's more of a right and less of a struggle, you know, and I think that's a beautiful thing. You know, that's what I fought for when my girls were young, and that's what I'm still fighting for today, you know, that we can have this just and be accepted, allow us to be ourselves, allow us to embrace those things that are thought of as feminine. And I don't necessarily mean the stereotypical things. I mean the things that are really beautiful, you know, like nurturing and caring and all the sensuality and all the things that I cover with the goddesses and the Orisha and the Loa that are in the book. And I think that really allows people to fully understand the depths of this sort of primal feminine that we're looking at.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are kind of scratching their heads about that because, you know, what is that? You know, I mean, and maybe Gloria Steinem comes to mind or something like that. And it's timely and it's important, and yeah, it's a really good book. And at the beginning of the book, you talk about training being very vital in any discipline, but it takes on special significance in a spiritual context, like voodoo, Santeria, hoodoo, and the other African-based religions survive on their lineage, their history, and training of its devotees. And you said that this is a book that needed to be written. Is it one of those cases where the author feels the need to write a book because that's a book that they would really need to read?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, I've been, you know, writing and lecturing and practicing and learning, you know, traditionally for over three decades now. And I think that there's a lot of questions that I had And there's a lot of questions that people come to me have, you know, how to find a teacher, why is it important to have a teacher, you know, and it was hard for me to, even to the people that when I was trying to write the book, it was hard for me to convince them that this was something that was necessary, because I think in a lot of other traditions, it's very, you know, intuitive or less, you know, teacher-student based, you know, and we don't even really think of it as teacher-student, it's more parent-child, you know. We get guided through this, and it's sort of a rebirth into a new life. And, you know, we have to be able to trust these people. They guide us, and they've been through it before, you know. It helps the same way that, you know, you can't turn a five-year-old loose in the kitchen with the stove and all of that because they might hurt themselves, you know. These people don't, and I'm not trying to scare people. I'm just saying that this magic is powerful. And if you don't know what you're doing, wouldn't it be better to have somebody who's going to guide you through it than make your own mistakes and possibly have things not go the way you want and, more importantly, need them to be?
Yeah, it's one of those cases where, you know, some parents will say, okay, well, let the kid, you know, if he's going to climb the fence, let him fall down. I'm not sure I totally agree with that. I think warnings are important, and I think a gentle hand in guiding is the most important thing, and that's exactly what you did with this book.
Thank you. I tried because, like I said, I didn't want to scare anybody, and you know, but to me, it's more of a blessing. You know, if I have a question and I can call, you know, my Santeria godmother, I mean, she just passed, but when she was still alive, I could call her and get guidance from her, and my Haitian Mambo, who I study with, and my own New Orleans voodoo priestess Miriam from the Voodoo Spiritual Temple. It's just very helpful, you know, like in matters of health, in matters of finance, in matters of love, and in matters of everything, really, you know, the same way it would be with a parent and child. And I have my own god kids, and they call me when they're, you know, looking for work or looking for, you know, something about their relationship or anything, you know, and that's how it goes. It's sort of that you give back to the community, and that's how the system works.
And it's really important too, because trust enters into that. And, you know, we're always looking for people to trust or information that we trust. And, you know, the way your book is written, anybody that reads it automatically can trust you, because it's written gently but informatively at the same time. And there's just so many things in there that's so interesting that, you know, it's kind of one of those, yeah, okay, I can read a chapter now. Maybe I'll put it down. Maybe not. Maybe I'll continue on. No, this is too good, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, it's written really well. And, you know, I was reading that you were also talking about the fact that African traditional religions were forced to remain shrouded in secrecy to keep the practitioners safe from persecution. And, you know, I mean, pagans had to do that too when Christianity came in. I mean, it's when people do that, when they're hiding to keep it going, I mean, the traditional religions made it through in spite of all that, you know, and it's all very empowering now in modern times. So I guess these traditions go from generation to generation with a mix of sheer will, faith, and maybe divine intervention and some syncretism as well.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about that a lot in the book, and I think that's a big sticking point for people who didn't necessarily grow up in the traditions, because a lot of times people are also practicing Christians at the same time that they're doing these African traditional religions. And, you know, I think for some people in the beginning, it was a way to sort of still honor these deities, but not suffer the, you know, backlash and persecution if they had had, you know, if we take, for example, Ochun, who I'm a daughter of Ochun in the La Regla Kumi, which people refer to as Santeria. And when you see traditional statues for Ochun, it's the Virgin of Caridad del Cobre. And, you know, there's a boat and there's three guys named Juan in it. And there's a whole story I talk about in the book. But you know, this goes back to, you know, some of the early stories in Cuba about, you know, three men were drowning and they saw the statue and it saved them. And you know, they recognized it as a manifestation of Oshun. And it was that. And also this virgin, you know, of Caridad del Cobre that people worshipped. It doesn't necessarily have to be a separate thing. And I think that's difficult for people who didn't grow up in the tradition to understand. You know, it's not necessarily that we're, you know, somebody, I said, well, isn't this cultural appropriation? I was like, if you're worshiping, but you can worship two things at once mm-hmm. without necessarily culturally appropriating these things. And I think specifically in this instance, you know, it's certainly not cultural appropriation because, you know, a lot of enslaved peoples were, you know, not given anything at all to read or look at except the Bible if they were lucky, you know. So this was the system that was forced on them and they had to have it in order to survive. So the fact that they were resourceful enough to still incorporate some of those beliefs, I think, is just phenomenal.
It is. And you know, I try to tell people because, I mean, we all know Christian druids. We all know Jewish witches. You know, I mean, we don't, in any of our religions, we don't say you can't practice everything or one thing, you know, because there is a good mix. We're not like dogmatic. And telling people, well, you know, if you're Christian, you better not even think about doing, you know, whatever.
Right.
And in voodoo, I mean, voodoo, as you know better than me, a lot of Christianity is in that. And people go, no, that can't be, you know, how can you mix those two things? Because, you know, voodoo is horrible. Well, read a book, learn things, keep an open mind.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my Haitian mambo, her name is Bonnie Devlin, and she's also a Unitarian minister, you know. So for her, it was just, you know, okay, this is something I practice. I mean, not to speak for her, but the way I understand it was she would practice this in a certain context and this other thing in a different context. You know what I mean? And that's what I witnessed, you know, all the times that I was with her, you know. So, again, I think it's all very respectful and it has to do with just honoring different systems. And that's something I stress in the book as well, that things should be done, you know, honorably and respectfully. And that's another reason that we have teachers and things like that. You know, I mean, if somebody was going to go make up Judaism and decide to go, no, I mean, people would not necessarily think that was the best idea. So I think a lot of people who want to honor their ancestors, and I'm all about honoring my ancestors, but there's also a system, you know, it's funny. My aunt actually came and to some ceremonies that I was doing and some of the feast food that I would cook for ritual and our ancestor feasts. And she'd look at me and she'd be like, your great grandmother made this exact same recipe. It tastes the same, you know? So for me, it was so interesting that I could come back to these recipes and these ways of honoring people that I had never even met, you know?
Yes.
It was like, wow. Oh, that's really cool. You know,
there's something magical about doing that, you know, recipes from 100 or 200 years ago that are available now. And you know, that's from kind of where your people came from and, you know, your relatives and your ancestors are that, and they ate the same thing. There's something very magical about tasting something that they tasted you know, or just carrying on the tradition, even getting that and saying, okay, well, you know, it's 100 years now. Well, I want my children and their grandchildren because this is such a good recipe. And then the stories start getting told about the ancestors and things. And I mean, that's the beauty of all this, I think, is just touching base and being one with them.
No, it is. It really is. And I've always, you know, that's what I learned when I was little. And that's what I taught my daughter when she was little, you know. And now she growed up and she runs a restaurant. So I'm a big foodie over here, you know. And that's why I have recipes in the book, you know.
Yes.
Again, that was always a struggle. You know, I think when I first started writing, people were like, oh, well, you know, people don't really want recipes in a magical textbook. And for me, eating really is magical. You know what I mean? That there's so many things that we put into our body and it doesn't have to be processed chemicals. It could be, you know, like you said, herbs that our ancestors used. And if we have that knowledge, oh, maybe I'm just grabbing for the basil or maybe I'm just grabbing for the sesame seeds. But if we know that those things are healing and we know those things are protective, then it adds a whole nother context to what it is we're doing.
Mm-hmm. I think so many of the people that listen to my show are foodies. You know, I mean, we just, that's what we do. You know, we write kitchen witch books and, and things. And I think it's really important to be able to keep, even if you don't know your ancestors, you know, a lot of people don't go that far back that they know, but they get to a certain point and you just kind of have to dig into it a little bit deeper, and you still feel it. You know, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to have the name of your great, great grandmother to appreciate something that, well, she did or might have done or something. So, yeah, I think ancestor worship is such an important aspect of living. I mean, you know, there's the old saying about you're only as strong as the thousand ancestors that are behind you, you know, which is a really nice way to put it. And I think they need to be revered. And I mean, I have an ancestor altar. I think everybody should, just so you can, you know, give them a nod every so often. Say hello, light a candle. I mean, they haven't forgotten us, but we tend to forget them. It's sad.
No, it's true. You know, and they went through so much. And I always, you know, suggest to people that if they're having a rough time, maybe consider, you know, like you said, lighting a candle or leaving out a glass of water or maybe even making a dish that they would have liked, so you can help connect with them and their insight and their wisdom in the matter. You know what I mean? Sometimes I'll even take it a step further. Like if I am, you know, if I have a legal question or a legal situation, my grandfather was an attorney. So, you know, he really liked Tic Tacs and beer. So if I have a legal question or a contract or something that's a little dicey that I want to understand better, you know, I'll leave him an offering and I'll sit down and I'll do a reading and see what it is I really need to know about the situation. The same way I would have done when he was still alive, you know, it's that kind of a thing.
Yeah, I mean, you have to kind of be careful though, because I have my altar in a bookshelf and it's kind of narrow. I mean, not very tall. And my grandfather, his thing was every night before dinner, he would have a shot of whiskey, schnapps, as he called it. And I thought, okay, so what am I going to put on the altar for him? I have his shot glass there. I think maybe I'll just, you know, put a little bit of whiskey in there, a little bourbon. And somehow, because it was like only open on one side, and it's right by my desk where I sit and work, I put it up there. I didn't think anything of it. I kind of walked away and did what I had to do, and I came back and sat down at the computer, and I almost fell off my chair. I mean, that was so powerfully strong, just sitting in that shot glass in there. And I thought, no, I'm not going to water it down, but I might just put just a tiny little bit in there, because that whole shot glass full, you know, made my eyes water. But we do this, you know, we do things for the ancestors. We know. And I mean, I have, this is really strange, but when my dad passed away, his brother sent me this whole suitcase that my grandmother, his mother, saved of his from the time he was a kid, all his letters from World War II and Korea. Wow. I mean, it was an amazing suitcase, and I was just floored when I got that. But one of the things in there were my dad's marbles. You know, he must have been like, you know, 10, 11 years old.
Yeah.
And so I've got a marble or two of his on the ancestor altar for him, you know, so you put little nice things. And yeah, I mean, they don't have to be things maybe that they did own, but maybe if you know that it's something that they liked or something, just put it out there.
Sure.
And yeah. So yeah, I think, like I said, everybody should have an ancestor altar because they're with us, whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not. And they guide us a lot. All right. So where did your spiritual journey begin? I don't think I asked you the last time.
I always felt kind of witchy, and I feel like people always say that. It's a bit of a cliche, you know, but I grew
up. True.
I'm a woman of a certain age. I grew up, you know, watching Bewitched and all the rest of that, and, you know, trying to do spells in the living room when nobody was looking. You know, so, but my parents really did name me Lilith. I always get that question when I'm getting interviewed.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
People are like, oh, I don't know. I was like, you know, so they knew all about the goddess and things like that. And, but it was, I wasn't, you know, in a coven or anything like that until I was much older. I started practicing probably when I was about 13 or 14 with my best friend. You know, we sort of found each other because we were the only black witches in our school. Probably the only black witches, you know, in that part of Brooklyn at that time, now that I think about
it. Maybe the only witches, period, at that time, too.
You know, I certainly remember going to, you know, everybody in New York talks about, oh, going into Magical Child and things like that. I certainly remember all of that, you know, and it was slim pickings. It was nothing like, I mean, for those of you who are younger witches than I am, it was nothing like it is today. It was certainly very hard to find like-minded people and mm-hmm. like-minded places, you know, so.
Or books, even.
Other than books, you know. I remember they told me, it's funny, I write for Wiser. I always talk about, I used to go into the store and anybody who was there, they used to have an antiquarian section. And when mm-hmm. I was like 12 years old, they wouldn't let me at the antiquarian section because I was a little girl and they thought I was going to mess up the books.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
I don't blame them. I probably would have done the same thing. I wouldn't let 12, you know, I'd really have to know the 12-year-old before I let them handle the, you know, antiquarian books. But I just, you know, at that point, I was like, I'm going to grow up and someday I'm going to write for these people. So.
And so you did. Yes.
And I did. You know. Yeah. Yeah. So, but no, I mean, I think that it was, you know, small things, you know, a lot of folk magic, a lot of hedge witchery, you know, mm-hmm. until mm-hmm. I finally got to, you know, I had my daughter when I, my oldest daughter, when I was 20. Mm-hmm. And when I went back to school after, because I had to drop out of school, when I went back to school, I was doing a lot of anthropology courses and stuff like that. And I was still practicing magic. And my teacher was like, oh, there's no such thing as witchcraft. There's no such thing as voodoo. And I was like, you're just another idiot, bald teacher that I'm not going to listen to, you know. And I just wanted to prove him wrong. And I wanted my girls mm-hmm. to have something that was really positive for them about African spirituality and their heritage. And there wasn't as much, there really, I mean, you had to really, really dig. I mean, this is back to, you know, when it was, Alice Walker had just found Zora Neale Hurston's grave, and like mm-hmm. a lot of this stuff was new, you know, and it certainly wasn't the wealth of information that we have today. So I sort of attacked it as both a scholar and a practitioner, you know, because I joined the Voodoo Spiritual Temple here in New Orleans when, let's see, they just had their 30th anniversary 2 weeks ago. And I think I've been going there for 28 years. So I've been around since almost the very beginning. So
That's a good place to begin, at the beginning, and mm-hmm. grow with it, in a sense, because that's what does happen. Now, the book unlocks the great mysteries of the ancient, powerful feminine realms of magic, and it introduces readers to the Orishas, the Loas, the goddesses, and each have their own energies and strength. And there are chapters devoted in the book to many of them, like Oya, Yamana, Nana Baruku. And with each, you explain their workings, their offerings, their candles, recipes, as we mentioned, and more. And we're going to get better acquainted with some of them when we come back from the break in a few minutes. But we do have a couple of questions from the chat room to get into. So how about the first one is, you mentioned syncretism. What is that and how does it work?
Well, most simply, people explain it as the sort of blending of traditions. Again, I mentioned it's not really cultural appropriation. It's more of a acquiring of certain pieces of it. I think that it happened definitely more prominently in colonial America, you know, both North and South America, where there were a lot of Christian people in power. And in order to practice, you had to adopt some of these ways, and eventually they became incorporated into the traditions.
Okay. And also, somebody said, you know, I've always felt a connection to the divine, but I don't know how to take the next step about going, strengthening it or being more connected to the goddesses and finding my path. Any suggestions?
Oh, okay. Well, you already had the best suggestion, Marla, talking about an ancestor altar, you know, because I think that that's a really good place to just sit and meditate and sort of get some of those answers. You know, if you do any kind of divination, you know, rods or pendulum or cards or anything like that, you know, maybe charge them up on the ancestor altar for a while, you know, maybe sit there and do a reading, you know, all of these things are helpful. And then another thing that people don't think of sometimes is, you know, I'm talking about the importance of the teacher, maybe light a candle to find the best possible teacher for you. Which, you know, my Santo Godmother, Oshun Olakariale, she always stressed that it should be the best situation for you. So maybe you saw somebody on the internet you think is really great or whatever, they got a lot of followers or whatnot. You know, what it's about is not getting that person for your teacher. It's about getting the best teacher for you. And maybe in that moment, you're going to have to wait a week. Maybe you're going to have to wait a month. Maybe you're going to have to do something slightly different and get out of your comfort zone in order to make it happen. But if you're really focusing your magic and your intent into finding the best situation for you, then it'll manifest.
Yeah, and finding paths, I mean, people keep thinking it's very difficult. You know, well, I don't even know where to look. I don't know where to begin. But I think sometimes just listening to shows like this or other things, picking up books that just kind of grab you, you know, if you're in the bookstore, if you're over at Amazon.com and you see something, I believe that things jump out at you and you may not realize it at the time, but those are the things that you should probably get interested in and follow. So I think it's kind of looking, I don't want to call them omens, but looking for signs of things that interest you. I mean, if you've heard somebody talking about Druidism, if you heard somebody talking about voodoo, if you heard somebody talking about anything and it kept your attention, that's probably where you kind of need to start. That's at least getting the foothold in. And,
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that 100%. You know, follow those things, follow your intuition, you know. I mean, I mentioned my priestess, I mean, my mumbo, Bonnie Devlin, when I was teaching at the UU Church. I think I was teaching, you know, intro to astrology and intro to tarot or something. It was 25 years ago. And,
some people still need refreshers on those for sure. Yeah, but anyway, go ahead.
No, it was a lot of fun. It was a good place. And, the church hired her to be their, you know, weekly minister. So, you know, I came in to work to do the workshops and they were like, oh, we just hired a new minister. We think you'll like her. She's Haitian mambo. And, you know, it was just so fantastic, you know, like, because I was living in New England at the time, you know, it wasn't a big city. I was like, where am I going to find a Haitian mambo? You know, and then the one just sort of showed up, you know, and I think that there are these fortuitous, you know, meetings and connections. And, you know, I love all my godparents. It's not about, it's not a race. It's about, you know, the journey is really what it's about. You know, I mean, if it had been that I met my godparents and it wasn't to work out, then that's what it would have been. You know, I've certainly had struggles along the way, but you keep trying to do your best and moving forward. You know, none of this happens overnight. I remember when I first started, they said none of it happens overnight because when you're still, you know, if you have children, if you're of childbearing age, then your focus is really at least 51% on that. So your spiritual dedication really has to wait until you're of a certain age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, age and mindset makes a big difference. And Kathy in chat just wrote, well, when the student is ready, the teacher will show up. And that's pretty true.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. There's always something you can do but to make yourself ready, I think. You know, but that's that the cosmos works that way. They find you the people you need.
I think one of the things that helps letting people in is lowering your walls, because we all have walls, but you don't realize that sometimes you build a wall that's all-purpose wall, and so nobody can get through to you no matter what. You know, I think if we're going to build up walls, and sometimes it's necessary, do them one at a time for the specific thing that you need at that specific time. You just can't put that fortress around you because you're not going to attract maybe some of the things that you need in life, like a person, like love, like knowledge or something. You keep that wall up and you can't chip through it and you're losing out a lot.
Sure.
And definitely. I guess the question there now is saying, well, how do I knock down those walls? You know, I mean, you know, this could lead into a very long discussion, but...
Yeah.
I guess it's the things that you're afraid of and the things that you have your backup on.
I'm a big believer. Have you ever read any Hodorowski and Psychomagic, Marla? I'm a big believer in all of
and
that.
And I should. You know, yeah, I've been interested in it.
He's got a real shocking way of getting people out of their comfort zone, which I just think is beautiful. You know, one of my, I took a workshop a lecture workshop with him a few years ago. And mm-hmm. most people know him from Holy Mountain, probably the most famous tarot movie ever. But he also developed his own system of magic. And, you know, he was talking about, you know, if you're going to go, it's going to sound wacky to people, but if you're going to go to a job interview and you're nervous, or now I guess it would be a video job interview and you're nervous, he's like, put meat in your pocket, which I was like, this is the most ridiculous thing.
I've heard that.
You're not going to get nervous. And then he looked and people were looking like, what in the world? And then he was just like, or lavender. And I just thought that was so beautiful. Because
oh, my God. I don't know where I heard that, but I have. I've heard about the meat in the pocket. I hadn't thought about that in 1,000 years, but.
Yeah. You know, and if that certainly takes you out of your comfort zone, you know what I mean? You're only going to be so like anxious and nervous about the interview if you're like, wait a minute, I've got some meat in my pocket. You
know? That brings such a great mental picture, honest to God.
Yeah. But no, it's those kinds of things. He really plays with the whole, you know, shock value of things to get mm-hmm. you out of your comfort zone, not in a dangerous way, but in a way that will just shake up your normal stuff. I had a teacher once, she was a Santera, and she would teach an intro to magic class that talked about, you know, if you're the kind of person that gets up every day at the same time and has the same routine and does the same things and has like everything in a very set way, then in order to make your magic better, you need to do everything different. You know what I mean? Wake up at mm-hmm. a different time, do things in a different order, you know, and vice versa. So, you know, if that's how you are, you need to just change up those routines because that will allow different things to happen.
Mm-hmm. And Kathy and Chet said, well, and the universe has its way. It'll drop kick you sometimes.
that's true too.
We've all got the bruises from that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we are going to rest our voices and our brains for just a couple of minutes, and so we'll be right back. Don't you go wandering off.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned.
Hey there. I don't know if you've heard, but there's a great new radio show on Para-X. Two hosts, 1 hour, and too much fun. Stephanie and Heidi not only talk about the latest goings-on in the supernatural worlds, they live it. They want to hear from you. They want to help you understand and guide you. And they want you to tune in. So, grab a friend or come alone to gather around that metaphysical table with Heidi and Stephanie. If you're interested in the worlds of the unseen, tune in to the Gathering Radio Show, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Para-X Radio.
You've no doubt heard of Tango and Cash, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Perhaps It Takes Two to Tango. Well, now, on the first and third Thursdays of each month, there's a show called Tango and Friends at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network with your host, Bruce Tango. And yes, there will be at least two to tango on each episode, sometimes even more. There's going to be lots of topics and lots of guests you'll all know and lots of surprises. Tango and Friends every first and third Thursday of the month at 8 p.m. right here on the Para-X Radio Network.
Missed an episode of Stirring the Cauldron? Then be sure to check out MarlaBrooks.com and check out the archive. And while you're there, check out Marla's weekly Witches Oracle card reading. Explore the site to find many great resources, such as information on tarot, oracle readings, metaphysical consultations, and links to all of Marla's books. That's MarlaBrooks.com. Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
And welcome back. My guest tonight is Lilith Dorsey, and we're talking about her new book, The Orishas, Goddesses, and Voodoo Queens, The Divine Feminine in the African Religious Traditions. Now, along those lines of people connecting with the feminine forces and finding a path, you say in the book that in some instances, people will be called by the feminine forces to choose, and in others, they will be gratefully chosen. So what are some of the signs that we might be gracefully chosen?
Well, I mean, I think dreams are always a good place to start. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that that's, and like you said, synchronicities or coincidences, you know, I think that that can be an indication that something is going on. You know, it's not, you know, time to run out and say, oh my gosh, this has happened. But it's certainly time to investigate. And I think that responsible investigation is important for people, you know, maybe if they're seeing, and that's why I really wanted to put all that information in the book. Like, these are the herbs for Ochun. These are the, you know, music for Ochun. These are these things. If this really resonates with you, then maybe if you have a chance to sit down and talk to somebody who's in the religion and dedicated to Ochun, it'll give you greater insight. If you have the chance to, you know, maybe get a reading and see if it's your path, then, you know, you can move forward. And I think that that's one, I think this is one of the biggest misconceptions from people outside of the religion too. You know, the first thing that we do in the religion is have, well, you, depending on what tradition it is, in Lukumi, it's called a rogacion. And Haitian Vodou, it's called a lave tete. Basically, it's a head washing. And it cleanses the head. It's like a spiritual baptism where you're reborn into the tradition. And it gives you great clarity. You know, when I do it for my god kids, they're like, it's just like, okay, all the outside noise gets sort of filtered out, and you have much more focus and intent. And, you know, you can tell what's good and what isn't a little teeny bit better, you know, for you. You know, I always ask my god kids to pray for gentle lessons. And I think that after you go through those things, you have the ability to recognize and choose gentle lessons better, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really important for people.
Yeah, that makes good sense. As we were saying, that chat room question came in. We were talking about getting to be the chosen ones. What if a person wanted to decline? Can they?
Oh, sure. You can always decline. I mean, I don't think it's like the, it's, well, it's certainly not like the Hollywood conception of it in any way, shape, or form, you know, and I think that's a real disservice that that's what people have contact with and not the reality of this beautiful traditions that we're talking about here tonight, you know. But I think that, yeah, sure, of course. But it's like, for me, it's the same thing as medicine, you know what I mean? If you found out that there was something not right with you and you know, there was a treatment, you could choose not to take it, you know, who knows what'll happen? Maybe nothing will happen. Maybe it'll get worse. Maybe it'll get better on its own. You know, it's sort of a little bit of a crapshoot. But if you try the recommended ideas, and they're reasonable ideas. Now, this is where going to a good practitioner helps, because there's certainly a lot of janky people out there that'll recommend some crazy stuff. One of my goddaughters, somebody, she got a reading from someone online, and they told her she needed to go to the woods and catch some pigeons with a stick. I don't even know what was going on with any of that.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it was. She's not a stick pigeon catching person.
So no, it wasn't gonna happen. That's funny.
It wasn't going to happen. But, like, you know, a lot of times it's something that's much simpler. You know, maybe a bath with some herbs, or maybe, you know, a lot of times when you're in a house, there'll be things like, oh, don't eat seeds, you know, this year. And there's a bazillion different reasons. Maybe the seeds will be, you know, contaminated. Maybe you'll get diverticulitis. Could you choose to eat seeds anyway? Yes, but chances are, you know, it'll be more risky if you don't follow those guidelines. So yes, you could choose to not do it. But to me, it's the same thing like as medicine. You could choose to not take. I could choose to not take my meds that I need to keep me healthy. And maybe I'll be okay. Maybe I won't. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. I'm just chuckling to myself because Kat in the chat room said, well, pigeons don't even live in the woods. So it's probably true. They kind of like big cities and, you know, tall buildings to fly to. I don't know. Or a lot of people to fly over and, you know, splat them. Because I think that's part of a pigeon's joy in this world.
Yeah, it is.
You know, zeroing in on somebody. But then, you know, in some cultures, that would be good luck.
Yes,
so definitely. they're doing people a favor.
Yes.
I mentioned a bit earlier before the break that we were going to get better acquainted with some of the, I'm still saying it wrong, but Orishas.
Okay.
And so the first one that jumped up and caught me when I was going through the book was Annie Christmas.
Oh, Annie Christmas, right on.
Yeah, see, they jump, that's my thing. When I'm reading books, things jump out at me, and that's when I have to talk about them. So maybe, you know, maybe she's asking me doing that so we can talk about her. So could you introduce people to Annie Christmas?
Sure, Annie Christmas. It's funny, Annie Christmas is kind of this folkloric character that, you know, gained almost goddess-like status over the years with people praying to her and asking her for things and stuff like that. People think originally that she either worked, you know, people call her Keelboat Annie and things like that, that she worked on one of the steamboats here in New Orleans, that she was like a steamboat engineer, or some people say that she drove a steamboat. There's all these different legends about her. But what they say that she was 6 feet tall and she used to beat up men who were abusive to their wives and girlfriends and things like that. And then there's all this legends about her, like taking people's teeth. And then some people say she had a necklace of pearls for everybody she beat down. There's all these
crazy, I like that.
I know. There's all these crazy, fantastic legends about Annie Christmas. And, you know, but for me, especially to include her in the book as this, you know, cultural hero, you know, I mean, I'm sure there was indeed a woman who existed and did a lot of these extraordinary things. You know, we'll never really know 100% which ones happened and which ones didn't, because it was a long time ago. But she's sort of taken this place where she has these traits that people don't necessarily think of as feminine. You know what I mean? Being mm-hmm. good with machinery, driving a boat, being an engineer, you know, being physically strong. A lot of these things are not things that are thought of as traditionally feminine traits, but they are. And, you know, this is how it manifested for her. And when people want to celebrate those traits in themselves, they can do well to connect with Annie Christmas. You know, Denise Alvarado has written a lot about Annie Christmas. Some of the other New Orleans people have written a lot about Annie Christmas. I know there's railroad tracks. When you go on the Riverwalk here in New Orleans, there's railroad tracks. You cross over to get to the Mississippi, and a lot of people leave offerings for her there, you know, to help gain strength and courage and, you know, vengeance over people who have wronged them and all of these things, which I think is so important for a lot of us today, that we have these situations where we can't necessarily get justice or can't necessarily, you know, feel protected and feel strong in a lot of areas. And she's really good for that.
Yeah, I mean, she it was really fascinating to read about her. But there are so many of them out there. How did you choose which ones would go in the book to introduce us to, as opposed to, you know, maybe book two?
Yeah, I wanted it to be a lot longer. You know, I'm sure some people reading it are thinking, there's not really very many goddesses in here. So,
but there's a lot on each goddess, so that makes up for it.
There is, you know. And some people think of them, you know, I mean, technically, some people will get upset if you call Loa and Orisha goddesses. I mean, I think if you come from a goddess tradition, you can certainly see that there's a lot of ways that they function in the same way, even if they want to be called by a different name, you know. I chose the ones that were the most popular. You know, if we look at Lukumi, you're definitely going to hear about Ochun, and you're going to hear about Yemaya, and you're going to hear about Nanabuluku, and you're going to hear about Oya. You know, you're going to hear about all of those. And I think that, again, I wanted to just sort of lay it out for people that these are, again, the most popular. People see there's a lot of herbs. These are the most popular herbs for them. Are there instances where there might be other herbs? Yes, of course. But these are the ones that are most popular and used for them most often, you know. So that's how I chose that. And I just sort of went through the systems. And it's like, you know, if people are going to be talking about some of the Erzulis, you know, for example, in Haitian Vodou, you know, so I talked about some of the ones that are going to show up most often. If you're going to go to, as we mentioned, a lot of these things are really out in the open now, and it's beautiful. If you're going to go to a public ceremony, chances are you're going to see some of these Loa there. And I just wanted to sort of help people understand better if they haven't necessarily grown up in the tradition, or if they, you know, maybe they know a lot about their own tradition, but they don't know about the tradition from another part of the world, that this would just sort of explain some of that stuff in a way that was understandable for them.
Mm-hmm. So who are some of the other characters that you have in the book?
Well, I mentioned the Erzulis. There's Erzuli Freda. There's Erzuli Mapong. There's Erzuli La Tiro, who likes to climb. People get possessed by her, and she mounts people like a bull, like just sort of climbs on top of them. It's an intense kind of thing. There's Aida Wado, who's one of my favorites, you know, because she's functions as a Loa, but in a way she's kind of almost a mother creator. When people talk about the serpent in the rainbow, Dambala, mm-hmm. her husband, is the serpent that goes beneath the oceans, and Aida Wado is the crown of the rainbow, and they meet together and the Americas, and they intertwined and they birthed the religion, you know. So it's just such a beautiful story. And I love this image of this rainbow serpent. You know, we get it in other cultures, you know, but in Haiti, Aida Wado is just, you know, limitless possibility. I tell people, imagine things better than you can possibly imagine. So, you know, you're not just getting, you know, $50 extra a week at work. You're getting $500 extra a week. You don't, you know, you go in, it happened to me today. A friend of mine needed a new battery for the car. We went in, the guy goes, here, just take it. It's like, oh, wow. You know what I mean?
Damn.
You mentally prepare yourself for this is the city. Oh, okay, maybe it's going to cost this much, or maybe it's going to be a hassle, you know, and then all of a sudden it turns into this beautiful, magical thing, you mm-hmm. know, and that's what Aida Wado's about. And it's so beautiful, so beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much information there, and really, really interesting. And, you know, one thing that I didn't think about, but I should have probably, I mean, we all have aspects of light and dark within us. And I'm guessing that goes for the goddesses and the Loas and the Oshiras as well. But are there any that are categorized as like gray as opposed to just light or just dark?
I think they're all gray, really.
Good.
I mean, okay. they all have, I'm not all about binaries anyway. So they all have these things where in certain circumstances, you know, they can be fierce, or in other circumstances, they can be gentle, you know, mm-hmm. in that way too, they kind of remind me of a parent-child relationship, you know, and that's how a lot of people really conceive of it, that it's this, you know, a guiding force. You know, if you do something that's dangerous, or if you don't listen to advice, you know, is mom and dad going to be mad? Probably, you know. Are they going to be gentle, you know? Yeah, hopefully, you know. And again, I'm not saying this to scare anybody, you know, but I think that, like I said, about the advice, you know, and if somebody tells you, oh, okay, well, today you need to just, you know, not really eat a bunch of sugar, you know, or whatever it is, and then mm-hmm. you decide to do it anyway, there's going to be consequences, you know? So I think that there's a lot of gray things, even the fiercest ones. When, if you look at, you know, there's Erzuli Danto, there's times when she comes out, and there's one that they call her the Seven Stabs. So it's kind of like Fight Club. She shows up and she's so fierce, she just starts stabbing herself. Like, I don't care what you do to me.
Oh my God.
Stab my own self. So you better get out of here. But she's another one that, again, protects, you know, women and children that have been abused, you know? And so in that situation, you know, maybe some fierceness really is warranted, mm-hmm. you know? So it depends on what you're coming up against. And I think that, yes, a lot of people do think of these things as, you know, dark, or try to think of things as dark and light. But in reality, there's a wide variety of responses to situations. And, you know, depending on the situation, something either light or darker might be necessary.
Yeah, well, I brought that up because you did talk about in the book about the light and the dark, and there, I mean, people sometimes, I don't know, I'm kind of not pointing fingers in any direction, but you know, you're talking about in, like at the other chapter, Death in the Crossroads, Santa Muerte and mm-hmm. Palmaguera, and people will not see that they're gray at all. You know, because I I've had people on talking about San Muerte, my good friend Tim Shaw, who that's his patron saint, and we did a whole show on her not long ago, and we just kind of explained that it's not what you think. It's not always what you think right away, you know. It's and so people will think, well, okay, if you talk about Santa Muerte, you talk about Marie Laveau, people think that she's a dark queen as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, so, I mean, and again, a lot of, I think, what people are internalizing are some of these media, you know, things about them they don't know. And that was really important for me to put a lot of the history in the book. You know, I mentioned I'm an anthropologist, you know, as well as a practitioner. And this is the stuff I find fascinating. You know, mm-hmm. the fact that she had her backyard was really sort of a refugee camp for indigenous, you know, Louisiana people who had been displaced. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just such a beautiful thing that she had like a tent. Anybody who wanted to stay, she had a tent city, you know, they were food and stuff like that. You know, she used to bring food to prisoners and stuff. You know, there's so many amazing philanthropic things that she did, you mm-hmm. know, that people just sort of aren't really familiar with.
Yeah, you don't. Well, you know, people don't talk about the good. They always talk about the bad because it's more exciting, I think. They get paid more attention if you say somebody, you know, you start gossiping about something, you're not going to gossip about how they, you know, saved something from whatever. You're going to say, well, you know, they think she shoplifts or something like that. I mean, that's just human nature to always pick on the juiciest, ugliest things because it keeps the conversation going, I guess. But it's not the right thing, I don't think.
No, it's true. It's, well, you know, what fascinates me is if you look at the reality of it, I think the reality is even more exciting. You know what I mean? That would have been a story I would have wanted to watch, you know, a documentary about her feeding indigenous Louisiana, you know, mm-hmm. native people in the backyard. That sounds fascinating. You know, did she punch somebody in the face and steal their statue? Probably. You know, that's the legend that goes around about her. You know, she had witch rivals. Anybody who's been in the witch community knows witch wars, you know. And mm-hmm. you know, what it was said that she used to do is just walk up and punch them in the face and steal their stuff, you know. So
she's got guts. Good. You know, can't stand namby-pamby. So, you know, that works well.
Yeah.
And then, you know, she probably had a good reason to do it. But I want to also, because we're got a little more time, but not a lot. But there's a whole lot more in the book that just, you know, the introduction to them. You know, you have like, you have herbs for the Orishas, Lois and the goddesses. You've got sacred dirts and crystals. You've got sacred symbols. I mean, there's a ton of stuff in this book that we're not going to have time to talk about. But again, sacred dirts jumped out at me. Let's talk about sacred dirts, what are they used for and all that, because I really like that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, I think at the core of it is, you know, this concept of Ashe, which people throw around a lot. Mm-hmm. And Ashe is basically the universal life force, the energy. You know, if you're familiar with the concept of chi, it's like the voodoo version of chi, mm-hmm. you know, and it's everything has an energy. So if you get dirt from the crossroads, that dirt is full of potential. It's a place of opportunity. So a lot of times what people will do is leave an offering, you know, traditionally 3 pennies, which would be for Eligua or Legba or something like that. And they would take some dirt and then bring that back home and use that in their magic for, okay, maybe you have a job opportunity you want to get, or maybe you have a situation where you want the doors to be open for you and you want, you know, I could think of a million situations where I waited online for an hour in the hot sun so I could buy some flower pots today. So she had brought some crossroads dirt, you know, but there's where things could go easy, as I mentioned, or it could go hard. So, you know, by maybe taking a little piece of that dirt that represents the Ashe of opportunity and potential and open doors, things will be a little bit easier for you on your journey. I'm not saying everything is going to be fine, because sometimes you need to wait. You know what I mean? Sometimes you need to take pause so something, you know, the butterfly effect, so something doesn't sort of get all out of whack and then things get worse down along the way. But sometimes, yeah, you can make things a little bit easier. You know, dirt from a hospital is supposed to be healing. Dirt from a courthouse if you're doing some kind of justice magic. It really is very logical. But when you think about it, okay, so how many people went through there and were, you know, filled with the anticipation of, you know, getting justice, getting whatever their fair share was when they walked into that courthouse? And that's really mm-hmm. what you do and what you're capitalizing on when you take that dirt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just love that concept. And it's funny because you were talking about Ashe, and all as you're talking about that, in my head is Witch Doctor Utu and the Ritual Drummers with that song. And the whole time you were talking, that song is going in my head. So thank you for that. You gave me an earworm, but it's a good earworm.
Fantastic. No, they're good friends of mine. Utu and I have been friends for 20 years. I'm calling him my work husband now. This is what I say when I get interviewed. But
I've got to get a hold of him because they sent me his book on Harriet Tubman a long time ago. And I with everything going on, didn't get to it. But I'm going to have to track him down and have him come on the show and talk about it because it's a really good book.
Yeah.
And now he got a free plug. And so did the drummers. But whatever. It's good.
It's fine. They're family. Like I said, they're family. It's all right.
Exactly. And we, you know, always support family. All right. So as usual, you know, like time is not on our side tonight. So I wanted to give you a chance to tell everybody about your books, your website, or anything else that you want to share.
Okay, cool. People can find me at LilithDorsey.com. There's information on there about my books and how to get a hold of me if you want to get a reading, and my blog and all that stuff like that. My blog is Voodoo Universe, so people can Google that and find me. And, you know, this is interesting. We live in interesting times. So, you know, if you want to catch me online, I'll be doing a lot of workshops online. I'm going to be doing Witches Fest in July. Then I'm going to be doing Hex Fest in August, and Sirius Rising also in July. So there's a lot of things. I think there's a Llewellyn online workshop I'm doing next month.
Wow.
Buy this book, Orisha's Goddesses and Voodoo Queens. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it. I felt bad. Somebody said they actually went into the Target and they didn't have it in the store, but they have it online. Barnes & Noble, all of that has it. And here's the surprise, because you said you liked me on the show, Marla. I have another book coming out this year, too. So at the very end of things, I have a book on water magic.
That's coming out in the fall. Great.
So, yeah.
Looking forward to that. And I think I've got Wiser brainwashed enough to know what to send me and when. So they know who I like.
That's good.
Which is really good. So I really appreciate you coming in. I really appreciate now I have another book to look forward to. That's great. And thank you for being here tonight. I was going to say do come back, but we just sealed that deal.
Yay. Thank you so much, Marla. It's always a pleasure.
And I also want to thank everybody for, you know, listening in and picking up on your wisdom and all that. And until next time, everybody, we're out of here. Blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Good night.
The circle be open, but unbroken. May the peace of the goddess be ever in your heart. Merry meet and merry part, and merry meet again. Merry meet again. Merry meet again.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited.